Well, good evening and welcome. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the New York Society Library. It's great to see such a good crowd here for our first event of our fall season. If you're a guest with us tonight, we're glad to have you, and we have membership brochures outside and a list of upcoming events if you'd like to know other programs that we're having this fall. If you have a cell phone, a pager, a BlackBerry, any device like that, even a computer, if it's going to make noise, if you'd take it out and turn it off, that would be wonderful. Our presenter will definitely appreciate it, as will everyone in the room. This is our annual fun time here at the library. Our membership fees cover only 22% of the library's general operating costs, so we do need your annual fund support to help us maintain the collection and have great events, build our children's library, and provide all the services we do here at the library. So thank you very much for your support. We're really fortunate tonight to kick off our season with author Ben Downing, who is a New Yorker, and he has published essays, articles, and reviews in the New Criterion and the Paris Review, as well as a book of poems, The Calligraphy Shop. Mr. Downing is the co-editor of the journal Parnassus Poetry and Review, which I brought a copy of, and you have to look at it after. It's one of the biggest, most robust literary journals in North America, with lots of very good content. His new book is Queen Bee of Tuscany, The Redoubtable Janet Ross, and it's been receiving very high praise. The Washington Post wrote that Queen Bee of Tuscany is a compendium of literary and historical vignettes, a showcase for its author's excellent prose, and quite simply, one of the best books of the year. We do have copies of the book for sale, and our friends outside from the corner bookstore will be happy to sell you a copy, and I'm sure Mr. Downing will be willing to sign for you after the event. So please welcome Ben Downing.
Thanks so much for that introduction, and thanks to everybody for coming. Oops, this is not going to work. How's the volume? Is that too good about there? Okay, tell me if it's too high or too low at some point. I'm actually going to read from something I've prepared tonight. I know that lacks something in spontaneity, but you wouldn't want me to try to do it off the cuff. There's really an awful lot that I want to try to squeeze into a short time, and I would just get lost if I tried to wing it. So I'm sorry. Yes.
Just a trifle louder.
A little bit louder. Is that better? Is good? Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I am going to read for the remainder of this time. So let me jump in. Let me explain first a bit about how this book came about. For most of my life, I've been a rabid Anglophile, and some years ago, I became interested in the British relationship to the Mediterranean, and especially in the long tradition stretching back to the 18th century of British writers and artists, most famously the Romantic poets, traveling in the Mediterranean, working there, living there, and interacting with each other in complex, often fruitful ways. Having decided that I wanted to try and write something about this tradition, I eventually zeroed in on the curious phenomenon of what was once known quasi-officially as the Anglo-Florentine colony, which crystallized in the 1840s and flourished for almost a century until it was driven out by Mussolini. In the books that I read about the colony, the name Janet Ross kept popping up, and she was always mentioned as someone larger than life, someone with a very strong personality, both admired and feared, the redoubtable Mrs. Ross, her contemporaries called her. I've used that on the title of my book, obviously, too. She also seemed to have had a paradoxical relationship with the rest of the colony, holding herself aloof from it while simultaneously exerting a fascination, almost a dominion, over it. When I discovered that her very substantial papers are at the British Institute of Florence, I decided to take a shot at a biography. As I started my research, I became ever more impressed by the richness of her life from cradle to grave, but also by her ancestors and descendants, who were clearly a very interesting bunch in their own right. So the book became, in part, a portrait of the family, especially its matrilineal side, which displays a striking continuity. Finally, it became a study of the ways in which later generations of the family extended the intimate relationship to Tuscany that Janet had established. But enough preliminaries. Let me jump in. While this talk is going to be more or less a digest of the book, I'm going to concentrate on the Italian part of it. And so what I'm going to do is give you a quick glimpse of Janet's ancestors and her early life, and then slow down once I get her to Florence. So let's begin with her maternal grandparents, John and Sarah Austin, who in 1819 married and moved to London so that John, who seemed destined for a brilliant career in jurisprudence, could be near his hero, Jeremy Bentham. Living next door to Bentham and his chief protege, James Mill, not to mention Mill's wildly precocious son, John Stuart, the Austins became part of what amounted to a utilitarian commune. They also began hosting a salon, attended by, among others, the poet Samuel Rogers, the wisecracking cleric Sidney Smith, and the future historian Thomas Babington Macaulay. As Janet puts it in her memoirs, their house became a resort of the most remarkable and cultivated people of that time. Established in the heart of intellectual London, the Austins seemed to be thriving. Yet John, depressive by nature, was turning out to be incapable of holding down a job or writing more than dribs and drabs of prose. Facing up to his inadequacy, Sarah became, as she phrased it, the man of business in our firm. Having a gift for languages, she began to earn a living as a translator from French and German. Nevertheless, by the late 1830s, the Austins could no longer afford London. The continent being cheaper at that time, they spent 2 years in Dresden and Berlin before moving to Paris, where Sarah started a new salon and accumulated a rather dazzling circle of friends, among them Tocqueville, the poet Lamartine, and the hostess Madame Récamier. But let me go back to 1821, when the Austins' only child, Lucy, was born. With John Stuart Mill for a babysitter and her mother teaching her languages almost from infancy, she had a sophistication far beyond her years, to the degree that she made friends with the poet Heinrich Heine, whom she met in France at the ripe age of 12. 5 years later, she met Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, the son of an MP who died young and left heavy debts. To get by, he'd taken a humdrum job at the Treasury, yet he was smart, handsome, good-natured, and, like Lucy, Teutonophilic. In 1840, they were married. Inheriting many of the Austins' old friends, they also made many of their own, including Dickens and Thackeray. Though they had little money or position, the Duff Gordons' warmth, wit, high spirits, and physical attractiveness made them one of London's golden couples. It was into this exuberant atmosphere that their first child, Janet Ann, was born in February 1842. In certain ways, she was the opposite of precocious, not learning to read till age 6. Dickens, she recalls, pretended to be terribly shocked at my resolute determination not to learn my letters. But her social skills were another matter. Consider, for instance, her 5th birthday party, for which she was allowed to draw up the guest list. The guests included Thackeray and the Whig statesman Lord Lansdowne, but not a single child. In 1851, the Duff Gordons moved outside London to Esher, where they rented a ramshackle former inn. It happened to be next door to Claremont, a royal estate that Queen Victoria had loaned to the family of the recently deposed King Louis-Philippe of France. Among them were two boys not much older than Janet, the Comte de Paris and the Prince de Condé, with whom she spent much of her time charging around the countryside on horseback. Eventually, her parents, troubled that she knew, by her own account, little but how to saddle a horse and how to ride him, sent her to Dresden for a year to learn German, and then took her to Paris for some months to improve her French. Having the family knack for languages, she was soon more or less trilingual. She was also poised, exceedingly confident, and rather beautiful. In fact, let's look at two portraits of her from the period. Let me see if I can get this. Yes, okay. So this first one, which is painted when she was 16, is by the leading Victorian painter George Frederick Watts, a close friend of the family. Throughout Janet's life, people commented on her large, dark, piercing eyes and thick, expressive eyebrows, and we certainly get a sense of them here. Now here's a portrait by another family friend, Henry Phillips. painted when she was 18. If less dramatically than Watts, Phillips also catches that the somewhat steely self-possession of his teenage sitter. Not surprisingly, Janet began to attract the attention of the opposite sex, including the poet and novelist George Meredith, who became rather obsessed with her and modeled one of his heroines on her. But whatever matrimonial designs Meredith may have had on Janet went unrealized. Instead, her hand was claimed by a certain Henry Ross. 22 years older than Janet, he'd spent much of his life knocking around the Middle East, and in the 1840s, he and his best friend, Austin Henry Laird, had discovered the ruins of the biblical cities of Nimrud and Nineveh, quite a coup for a pair of amateur archaeologists. More recently, Ross had become a banker in Alexandria. In the summer of 1860, he was back in England on holiday, and Janet met him at a country house party. His Indiana Jones-like past was complemented by his fluent gifts as a raconteur and by his rugged appearance and extraordinary mustache, as you can see here. Something, right? Once Janet satisfied herself that he was also a good horseman, she agreed to marry him. In December 1860, the couple married and left for Alexandria. Though Janet took an immediate dislike to the city, she contrived to spend relatively little of her time there, instead escaping to Cairo, which she loved, and embarking on various adventures in the desert, including a horse race in which she humiliated a member of the ruling family of Egypt, in an exhilarating tour of the half-dug Suez Canal with its developer, Ferdinand de Lesseps. She also made her debut as a writer, serving for over a year as the Egyptian correspondent for the London Times. This is at age 20, she did this. Now, I should mention that Janet wasn't the only member of her family writing about Egypt at this time. Her mother, Lucy, who'd contracted tuberculosis, had more or less settled in Luxor. And in 1865, she published her book, Letters from Egypt, which made her something of a celebrity. When the Rosses visited her in Luxor, they were amazed and moved by the degree to which the locals had adopted Lucy as one of their own. For the Rosses themselves, however, Egypt had begun to sour. During the U.S. Civil War, the Egyptian economy had boomed on the strength of cotton exports. But in 1866, with Dixie cotton coming back on the market, the economy went into a tailspin. With unfortunate timing, Henry and his partners had launched an ambitious new venture, the Egyptian Commercial and Trading Company. Though Henry was able to salvage part of his investments, he and Janet found themselves with severely diminished financial prospects. Since they couldn't afford the sort of English country house life they'd hoped for, they began to consider alternatives, and their gaze soon fell on Florence. It was agreed that Janet would go there ahead of Henry, who had loose ends to tie up in Alexandria. Pardon me one sec. Now let me step back for a moment to comment on the family connection to Italy. In truth, there wasn't one to speak of. None of Janet's immediate family had ever set foot in Italy, their interests being centered on Germany and France. As for Janet, she too had never been to Italy until 1866, when she was invited by Henry's old friend Laird to go to Venice for the triumphal entry of King Victor Emmanuel. This was during the final phase of the Risorgimento, which saw Venice taken away from the Austrians. It was a stirring experience and no doubt helped incline Janet toward Italy. But why Florence specifically? One attraction was the presence of her cousin, Sir Henry Elliot, who happened to be the British ambassador to Italy, Florence having been the capital at this time. But the strongest draw was the city's cheapness, particularly with regard to real estate. Even if they didn't like it, the Rosses wouldn't go broke there. I know this seems remarkable now when, you know, Florence cost an arm and a leg, but it was probably the best bargain in Europe at that time. At any rate, Janet arrived in Florence in May 1867. Now, when I reached this point in my book, I put the Rosses aside for about 40 pages to consider the development of the Anglo-Florentine colony up to 1867. For lack of time, I can't really go into the subject here, but let me say a few words about it, since I'd like to give you some sense of the tradition that the Rosses were about to join. Through much of the 18th century, Florence had a sizable British community. It was largely rich and aristocratic, a pleasure-loving smart set. In 1799, what remained of this bunch was chased out by Napoleon, but by the mid-1820s, a more various crowd had replaced it, including the hot-tempered poet Walter Savage Lander and Seymour Kirkup, a charmingly eccentric painter, antiquarian, and occultist. Then, in the mid-1840s, the British presence in Florence, merging with the smaller but robust American one, solidified into what people began to refer to as a colony. Besides Robert and Elizabeth Barrett Browning and their celebrated Cocker Spaniel, Flush, its members included Fanny and Thomas Adolphus Trollope, the mother and elder brother of Anthony Trollope, and several then-famous sculptors, such as Hiram Powers. Nor was it exclusively artsy. For example, Mary Somerville, one of the leading scientists of her time, was also on the scene. Some of you may be familiar with Somerville College, Oxford, which is named after her. What made Florence attractive to so many? Again, it was staggeringly cheap, not to mention beautiful and stuffed with great art. It was relatively clean, safe, and healthy, and its government was, especially compared to the repressive powers of southern Italy, the Papal States, and the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, remarkably liberal and benevolent. In the words of the Irish novelist Charles Lever, it was a government so mild as to be no government at all. Furthermore, Florence catered to those who craved the comforts of home. The Via Tornabuoni, a street in the center of town, was full of shops selling British food, clothes, pharmaceuticals, even umbrellas. There were several Anglican churches, and parents could send their sons to Dr. Broomback's Academy for the Sons of Gentlemen. The Grand Café Doni was always packed with English speakers, and one could read the latest periodicals at the Gabinetto Viesseux, a well-stocked library. By the mid-1860s, many of the leading colonists had either moved away or died. But others remained, and they were joined by a fresh wave of expats, Janet and Henry Ross among them. The Rosses' first few years in Florence were anxious and unsettled, and they were often out of town for long stretches. The year that marks their real commitment to the place is 1871, when Rome became the new capital of Italy. They'd recently become friends with a middle-aged bachelor marchese named Lotaringo della Stufa. Lotto, as he was known, was a chamberlain in the household of Victor Emmanuel, and when the king moved to Rome, he was obliged to follow. This pained him, for he was much attached to his estate, Castagnolo, located 7 miles to the southwest of Florence in Lastra Asinia. He planned to return whenever possible, but he wanted someone to look after the place when he was away. So he made the Rosses a proposal. They could have an entire wing of the house to themselves in exchange for keeping an eye on the place. Since they'd been wanting to get out of the city anyway, they jumped on the offer, and they wound up staying at Castagnolo for 17 years. The travel writer, Augustus Hare, who several times stayed with the Rosses at Castagnolo, wrote of its, quote, charming old halls and chambers connected by open arches and filled with pictures, china, books, and beautiful old carved furniture. A terrace lined with immense vases of tulips opens on a garden with vine-shaded pergolas and huge orange trees in tubs. But Castagnolo wasn't just a house. It was also a tenuta, or farm estate. Like nearly all such estates in Tuscany, it was run on a sharecropping system known as mezzadria, the basic principle being that the harvests were evenly split between the padrone and the contadini, or peasants, who farmed his land. Unlike some padroni, Lotto was a man of almost Tolstoyan benevolence, with a deep concern for the well-being of his tenants and a keen interest in the art of farming. It was therefore a mark of his confidence in Janet that he let her fill his shoes as a sort of deputized padrona. Though she had no experience with agriculture, she proved to be a natural and also to have a knack for leadership. Castagnolo's tenants must initially have found it both freakish and galling to find themselves being bossed around not just by a foreigner but by a woman, but they soon accepted Janet's rule and even came to like and trust her. One reason she was so good at disarming suspicious peasants is that she knew their music. Being fascinated with Tuscan folk songs, in particular with those known as stornelli, She learned a large repertoire of them, and she liked nothing better than to walk across the fields while strumming her guitar and belting out traditional ballads with Castagnolo sharecroppers. Augustus Hare remarked that her stornelli were rendered with all the verve which a contadina herself could give them. It is no wonder the Italians adore her. She also routinely sang stornelli with the three Orsi brothers who lived at a nearby villa. The youngest of them, Carlo, who was just starting out as a painter, became one of her closest friends. Later, he would illustrate several of her books, but first she posed for him, resulting in two arresting portraits. This one, which I used on the cover of my book, it's actually a drawing which was colorized. And then there was this one, which is quite a different matter. Janet's depicted as a sort of a bookworm odalisque. I don't know if you can make out. She has a little tiny volume that she's reading there. Somewhat provocatively, she hung this picture above her bed. By this point, Janet was spending most of her time among Italians, but she had no shortage of international company. A steady stream of friends from abroad came to stay at Castagnolo, often timing their visits to coincide with the grape harvest, or vendemmia, in which they liked to participate. It was almost a prototype of today's so-called agriturismo vacations. As Janet's reputation grew, she also found herself visited by eminent strangers, such as William Gladstone, who came for lunch, and Henry James, who stayed for 3 days and afterwards described Janet as, quote, an odd mixture of the British female and the dangerous woman, a bohemian with rules and accounts. As for her fellow Anglo-Florentines, Janet was friends with many of them, but kept her distance from the social scene at large, disliking its enclave mentality. Nevertheless, she was a staple subject of colonial gossip, especially beginning in 1878, when she found herself caught up in a teapot tempest of unusual violence. With her beauty, haughtiness, and preference for male company, Janet had, over the years, rubbed plenty of women the wrong way. But in the late 1870s, she made a bona fide enemy in the form of the popular novelist known as Ouida, who'd recently moved to Florence. Ouida, whose appearance was widely described as grotesque, happened to meet and fall in love with Lotto, who did not return her affections. Somehow, she convinced herself that Lotto had spurned her only because he was under the Svengali-like control of Janet, who kept him as an erotic plaything and who was now using him as a cat's paw to torment herself, Ouida. She therefore resorted to the novelist's weapon of choice, the poison Romana clay. Published in 1878, the novel was called, with heavy irony, Friendship, and was unmistakably based on the Castagnolo menage, with Janet cast as the wicked Lady Joan Chaloner. A feeble and preposterous book, it sold, by Ouida standards, poorly, but within the hothouse world of the colony, it was all the rage. If Ouida's biographers are to be believed, it ignited a firestorm among the Anglo-Florentines, dividing them, like a sort of Dreyfus affair avant la lettre, into Ouidaites and anti-Ouidaites. The majority seemed to have concluded that Ouida, hoist with her own petard, had done far less damage to Janet's reputation than her own. Janet was rumored to have publicly horsewhipped Ouida in retaliation. But in truth, she more or less shrugged off the whole silly episode. Her one small gesture of reprisal was to place a copy of Friendship, stripped of its binding, in the lavatory at Castagnolo, implicitly inviting her guests to use it as toilet paper. By the time of the Ouida affair, Janet herself had begun to write again. Her first topic was, quite simply, the world at her doorstep. Few, if any, foreigners had so intimately participated in the rural life of Tuscany, and none, at least in English, had written about it from up close. Beginning in 1875, Janet published in leading British magazines a series of learned yet appealingly casual essays with titles like Vintaging in Tuscany, Oil Making in Tuscany, Popular Songs of Tuscany, and Virgil and Agriculture in Tuscany. 14 of these essays were gathered into her book Italian Sketches, with lovely etchings by Carlo Orsi. She also began to write about her family, publishing Three Generations of English Women as sort of epistolary biography of her maternal ancestors. Nor was writing Janet's only creative activity. At Castagnolo, Henry had fulfilled a long-standing ambition by becoming a cultivator of orchids. To help him catalog his large collection, she began painting it. Despite her lack of training, she was good enough at this painstakingly detailed work that Kew Gardens, outside London, eventually acquired about 750 of her orchid watercolors. In short, Castagnolo brought Janet to fruition as a dynamic, multifaceted woman with unusual sorts of knowledge at her fingertips and a wealth of practical experience under her belt. But this chapter of her life was about to close, for in 1888, Lotto fell mortally ill. Knowing that his heirs wouldn't let them remain at Castagnolo, the Rosses began a long search for a home of their own. Eventually, they settled on a place near Settignano, about 2 miles to the northeast of Florence. Poggio Gherardo, it was called. Though properly a castellated villa, the Rosses and their friends liked to think of it as a castle. With its merlons, towers, and hilltop position, it does have a castle-like quality, as you can see in this 18th century fresco detail, which I've actually used on the back of my book. There it is, perched up there. So. Shortly after settling into Poggio, as I'll henceforth call it, the Rosses discovered that it had a rather romantic history, having often been put forward as the model for one of the houses where Boccaccio has his plague-fleeing characters hole up in the Decameron. But Poggio wasn't just a castle. It was, like Castagnolo, a mezzadria estate with about 60 acres of land divided into three poderi, or farms. Unfortunately, it was in far worse shape than Castagnolo, its previous owners having let it run to seed. Everything from the castle to the tenants' cottages to the land itself was badly in need of renovation. Still on a tight budget, the Rosses dispensed with contractors and oversaw the job themselves. With room to spare, they converted a wing of the castle into lodgings for their hired workers. And within a year, Poggio was not only salvaged, but made vibrant and inviting. On its terrace, which afforded wonderful views of Florence, the Rosses replanted the pergola with grapevines and stocked the fountain with a beautiful breed of chiffon-tailed Burmese goldfish. They established a rabbit pen and a poultry yard, stocking the latter with chickens, ducks, and resplendent golden and silver pheasants. Glass houses were built for Henry's orchids, and new trees, flowers, and shrubs were planted in great profusion. Let's look at a few pictures of Poggio from back then. Here's one of the castle as seen from just outside. And here, unfortunately it's not the best picture, but I hope you can make it out, is one of its more unusual features, the so-called poodle room. That's the poodle, if you can make him out. This poodle was, this heraldic portrait, you might say, of this poodle was a dog named Pippo, an 18th century pet cherished by the Gherardi, the family that owned the castle for centuries. And finally, here's a picture of the kitchen, which is big enough to make pretty much any of us New Yorkers green with envy, as you'll see. There it is. Yes, right. Turning her attention to the farms, Janet took them very firmly in hand. While carefully respecting the conventions of mezzadria, she was determined to introduce certain agricultural innovations, and these alarmed her sharecroppers, who, like nearly all Tuscan peasants, were highly conservative. She forced them to plant a new Australian strain of wheat and insisted that they prune their grapes differently and harvest them later. These and other changes at first met with resistance, but the contadini came around once they saw that their yields actually improve. In a letter, Janet boasted that, quote, "The peasants have now a great respect for the padrona's agricultural knowledge." Over time, most of them came to feel great affection and gratitude toward her, for she treated them with a kindness and solicitude that they wouldn't have found at most Tuscan-run estates, even bringing in her own personal physician to treat them when they were ill. Here, by the way, is a picture of a few of them shown hauling grapes during the vendemia, the grape harvest. Besides their sharecroppers, the Rosses also had, for employees in Tuscany, where as affordable as real estate, a staff that included a cook, a gardener, a maid, and a butler come major domo. What they signally lacked, however, was children. Actually, that's not quite true, for Janet had given birth way back in 1862 to a son, Alec. Mysteriously and rather painfully, neither she nor Henry showed much interest in him, farming him out to be raised by a maiden aunt in England. But another child, or rather a teenager, was about to come into their lives. In 1874, Janet's dissolute and alcoholic younger brother, Morris, had had a daughter, Lena, with his wife, Fanny. About 12 years later, Morris ran off with another woman, and Fanny, too distraught to care for Lena, put her in a convent school. Some 3 years after that, Fanny was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Determined to find a proper home for Lena before she died, she made a desperate pilgrimage to Poggio to ask the Rosses to take her in. They agreed, and in 1890, they legally adopted Lena. Nor were they parents merely in name, lavishing on Lena all the affection they'd withheld from Alec. It wasn't difficult, for she was a prepossessing girl, pretty, clever, and intellectually curious. Let's look at a few pictures of her, both of which date from about 10 years after her arrival at Poggio. Here's one by George Frederick Watts, who painted the portrait you saw earlier of Janet. And here's a photo of Lena with the Rosses and an unidentified terrier of some sort outside, standing outside the house. But let's go back to Lena's story. Having spent years in dreary convents, in dreary convent schools, she immediately and gratefully responded to her rich new environment. Janet arranged for her to take art lessons with Carlo Orsi and Italian lessons with her friend Dr. Guido Biaggi, head of the Laurentian Library. Before long, Lena was a rabid little Italophile and a worshiper of the heroes of the Risorgimento, filling her bedroom walls with portraits of Garibaldi and Mazzini. As for Lena's relationship to Janet, it was close from the start, but was made even closer by means of a sort of group friendship that sprang up soon after Lena's arrival. Back in 1882, Janet had become friends with John Addington Symonds, who's probably familiar to you for his learned books on Italy and much else. He'd stayed with Janet at least once at Castagnolo, but at Poggio he became a regular visitor, in part because he was doing research in Florence for a biography of Michelangelo. Frequently joining Symonds on his visits to Florence was his daughter Madge, who was then in her early 20s and was making her own start as a writer. Janet immediately took to Madge and John to Lena, and above all, Madge and Lena to each other. In the early 1890s, they were constantly in each other's company, Lena going to stay with Madge and her father in Venice, where he kept a pied-à-terre, and Madge sometimes coming on her own to Poggio. Then, in the spring of 1893, tragedy struck, and in a haunting manner. Symonds, who'd just published his Michelangelo biography, had been invited to give a lecture on the artist in Florence. Since he couldn't be there on the requested date, he wrote the lecture and asked Janet to have it translated into Italian and read for him. She lined up Enrico Nencioni, a respected scholar. On April 19th, the lecture was read. Though it went over well, while clapping afterward, Janet unaccountably found herself seized by, as she puts it, a feeling of intense anxiety. That evening, she got news that Symonds had died in Rome, only hours before the lecture. We had, she writes, unwittingly been applauding the words of a dead man. Though Janet never stopped missing Symonds, for whom she harbored an especially tender affection, she had no shortage of other friends, both abroad and in Florence. Mainstream colonial life still left her cold, and she rarely went into town for social occasions. She was happy, however, to let the town come to her. It now did so on a weekly basis, for the Rosses began throwing a party every Sunday. Over the years, these parties became an institution and one whose renown spread well beyond Tuscany, so that British and American tourists with no direct connection to the Rosses would angle for invitations. For many people, a Sunday pilgrimage to Poggio was considered an essential part of their trip to Florence. Though the castle's fine views and excellent food were part of the attraction, the main draw was Janet herself. who would sing duets with Carlo Orsi and tell stories of her high Victorian childhood and the rest of her colorful past. Another reason why Janet saw little reason to go into town to socialize is that she had increasingly interesting neighbors. Among them was Mark Twain, who in 1892 washed up in Florence with his family looking for a house to rent. A friend of his suggested that he consult Janet, who promptly found him an enormous villa, the Viviani, just down the road from Poggio. Soon Twain was a regular presence at Poggio, where he liked to chat with Janet about crops. At one point, he even arranged for the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture to send her packets of corn, of American corn and watermelon seeds. Though Twain only stayed in the area for 6 months, another American neighbor settled in for good. The Rosses first met Bernard Berenson in 1895 when he was living near Fiesole and carrying on an illicit relationship with a certain Mary Costello, who'd abandoned her husband and ran off to Florence with Berenson. Soon the Rosses, along with Lena, were firm friends with both of them. Let me read, as an illustration of this new friendship, part of Mary's diary entry for her 35th birthday in February 1899. We ended up at Poggio, with Lena making a fiery procession through the olives. Then we went in and had dinner, and I found a great bunch of orchids on my plate, and my health was drunk in champagne. Mr. Ross told me stories of crocodile shooting on the Nile in the days before steamboats, and Mrs. Ross talked scandal. Only months after this dinner, Mary's husband conveniently died, and she and Bernard were finally able to wed. They then moved into a villa, Itati, that happened to be just downhill from Poggio. Bernard would go on to become the most famous art historian and connoisseur of his day, and both he and Mary would be a major presence in Janet's life for decades to come. Let me just say parenthetically, by the way, that there's a new biography of Berenson coming out next month that looks really promising, Rachel Cohen. So, fascinating man. Haven't read it yet, but it looks really good. Let me focus for a moment on Lena, who by 1900 was in her 20s and well embarked on her own career as a writer. She and Mad Simmons had co-written, at the urging of the publisher J.M. Dent, a book called The Story of Perugia, and Lena alone had gone on to write, also for Dent, The Story of Assisi. She'd also fallen in love with a handsome and somewhat arrogant young painter named Aubrey Waterfield, whom she'd met back in England. Here's a picture of him. In 1897, Aubrey came to visit Lena in Florence, impulsively proposed to her, and then got cold feet, breaking the engagement. 3 years later, he proposed anew, and this time the engagement held. Janet, however, was ferociously opposed to the match, Aubrey's haughtiness and lack of financial ambition having made a terrible impression on her. Not content to proclaim Aubrey a worthless loafer, Janet warned Lena that if she married him, it would surely kill Henry, who'd recently suffered a series of strokes. Tongue twister. On July 1st, Lena went ahead and married her dreamy painter. 3 weeks later, while on honeymoon in Devon, she received word that Henry had died of a massive final stroke. Even though her marriage obviously hadn't caused it, Lena was guilt-stricken, and Janet beyond furious. When, a few months later, a misunderstanding led Janet to think that Lena was contesting Henry's will, a deep freeze settled on their relationship, and they barely saw each other for years to come. Back at Poggio, Janet, by now almost 60, was shattered by Henry's death. But eventually she picked herself up, and her quarter century of widowhood saw a revival of her multifarious energies. She oversaw Poggio as painstakingly as ever, and even began turning out a new product, a vermouth made according to a secret Medician recipe that, she claimed, a descendant of the family had given her. The vermouth was sold at stores all over Florence. She also began writing again. Let me take a moment to review her literary career, since it hasn't been mentioned in a while. Though nearly all of Janet's Italian writings are about Tuscany, there's one interesting exception. Back in the 1880s, she'd become friends with Sir James La Caita, a naturalized Briton who owned a beautiful estate in his native Puglia. Janet often went to stay there. And she became so fascinated by Puglia that she decided to write a book about it. namely Land of Manfred, which ambitiously combines contemporary travelogue with disquisitions on the medieval Hohenstaufen dynasty in southern Italy. Next, she wrote a memoir of her youth, Early Days Recalled, followed by a book on Florentine villas, and then a book called Leaves from Your Tuscan Kitchen, or How to Cook Vegetables. It's a great subtitle, right? Somewhat ironically, this last book has proven to be her most successful, going through many editions. There's actually a copy over there. The irony is that she whipped it off in no time at all and was utterly incapable of making any of its recipes, which were instead prepared by her chef. I know nothing about cookery, she once admitted, never having even boiled an egg in my life. For several years after Henry's death, Janet had written nothing, but now she went back to work with a vengeance, writing two books commissioned by J.M. Dent, Florentine Palace and The Story of Pisa. In 1910, she published a book of her own conception, Lives of the Early Medici, as told in their correspondence, which skillfully strings together letters from several generations of the Medici, all of them translated by Janet and linked by learned commentary. Coming from the pen of a 68-year-old autodidact, it's a very impressive volume. Finally, in 1812, came the fourth generation, which subsumes her earlier autobiography and brings it up to date. Though rather slapdash, it too is remarkable in its way, since it unfolds her life in its full color and dynamism. One reviewer captured this in an inspired metaphor, observing that Janet, quote, seems to drive with immense skill and grace a 20 in hand, a coach that is, composed indiscriminately of horses, dromedaries, camels, mules, poets, historians, painters, politicians, and financiers. Now let me shift back to Lena, since she's about to re-enter the story. In 1903, she and Aubrey had their first child, Gordon, and had collaborated on another book for Dent, Rome and Its Story, Lena writing the text and Aubrey doing the illustrations. They'd also acquired their own foothold in Tuscany. Aubrey was friends with the British consul in Genoa, Montague Yates Brown, and had once stayed with him at his castle in Portofino, the same castle, incidentally, that inspired Elizabeth von Arnim's Enchanted April. Brown owned several other properties, including one in the rugged, remote, and backward Lunigiana in the northwest corner of Tuscany. It was called the Fortezza della Brunella. Perched atop a hill among the peaks of the Apuan Alps, this 16th-century fortress is wildly dramatic and romantic, and Aubrey had long dreamt of living in it. Before going on, let me quickly show you two contemporary pictures, actually, of it. Pretty serious, right? Anyway, in 1903, Aubrey took Lena to see the fortress, and she too succumbed to its appeal. Montague Yates Brown let them have the place for a negligible rent, and just like that, they committed themselves to living in a place of the utmost impracticality. But they were nothing if not venturesome, and before long they'd made the fortress habitable. Aubrey, who was a gifted gardener, laid out a paradisal garden on its roof, complete with an avenue of ilex trees. In warmer months, they slept on the roof in hammocks, hauling their food and drink up from the courtyard by means of a pulley. Happy together and thrilled with their new home, they wrote and illustrated a book about the Lunigiana, home life in Italy, letters from the Apennines. And they received a steady flow of curious friends, including the Berensons, D.H. Lawrence, and Aldous Huxley, the setting of whose 1925 novel, Those Barren Leaves, is unmistakably based on the fortress. One person who pointedly didn't visit the fortress was Janet, who continued to be frosty. In 1912, however, she abruptly softened toward Lena, and when World War I broke out, she invited her to come stay at Poggio with her two young children, John and Corinthia, known as Quinta. As the war dragged on, life at Poggio became harder, for a good number of its tenants had been called away to fight, and food was increasingly scarce. Rising to the occasion, Janet not only tended to the needs of her dependents, but launched a series of charitable ventures to help refugees and local peasant families. Lena, meanwhile, made her own contribution. Concerned that the Anglo-Italian relationship was being severely strained by the war, she co-founded the British Institute of Florence, which opened in 1918, and it was the world's first British cultural institute abroad. In 1919, Lena and her children returned to England, and Janet, now nearing 80, was on her own again. With the Italian economy in tatters, food became scarcer than ever, to the point that we find Janet reporting in a letter, "I've signed the death warrant of my pretty gold pheasants, and I'm going to eat them." She found it hard to get by on her small income, and she worried about the agrarian revolts breaking out all over Italy. "Mezzadria is a thing of the past," she wrote to Lena in 1920. To her relief, though, her own tenants never rose up against her. But she did fall victim to the lawlessness that increasingly plagued the area. At one point, 50 men from a nearby village showed up at her door and demanded all her stocks of wine, olive oil, and corn, along with a horse and cart to haul away their loot. She had no choice but to comply. In 1922, Lena began staying with Janet again on a regular basis, for she'd been appointed Italian correspondent of The Observer, the British paper, that is, and needed a more central base than her fortress. She conducted numerous interviews with Mussolini, and her articles became increasingly critical of fascism. As for Janet, her own reaction to fascism was muted. She didn't quite stick her head in the sand, as many colonists did, but neither did she raise her voice against the encroaching tyranny. Instead, she spent her last few years busying herself among her sharecroppers and making new friends. One of these was the Italian explorer Filippo De Filippi, who lived in a nearby villa. In her memoirs, Lena records an amusing exchange between him and Janet. I should preface it by saying that Janet, despite her deep learning in certain areas, had strange gaps in her education. She never learned to multiply, for instance. At any rate, the explorer dropped by Poggio one day, and Lena overheard the following exchange. "Filippo, you're just the person I want. Now, what is the equator?" "It's an imaginary line circling the earth," he answered. "Imaginary line," she repeated contemptuously. "I never heard of anything so ridiculous." Janet also continued to receive guests from abroad, and one of them is deserving of note. In 1925, her old friend Charles Bell, head of the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford, came to visit, bringing with him a young art history prodigy named Kenneth Clark. When Bernard Berenson, dazzled by Clark's talent, hired him as an assistant, Janet offered to let him stay on, and over the following months, he spent a good bit of time at Poggio. His memoirs include some delightful bits about Janet, such as the following. "Like all Victorians of the upper class, she resolutely disbelieved that anyone except the eldest son was the child of his or her father, and came out with some staggering deviations." Unfortunately, Clark was among the last of Janet's guests, for in 1927, she contracted an aggressive cancer. She remained vital and pugnacious almost to the end, lambasting, as Lena put it, the usual bete noire in her old vigorous way. But on August 23rd, she finally died at 85. Before moving on, let's take one last look at her. I'm not sure when this photo was taken, but clearly toward the end of her life. And we can see her in her study surrounded by mementos, including a bust of her father there, and then drawings and family portraits by, among others, Thackeray, who was actually quite a good artist, and Watts, and Edward Lear, and many others around the room. Though it's not a great photograph, I think it stands as a symbol of the density, coherence, and interconnectedness of her life. So I rather like it. In her will, Janet left Poggio to Lena's son, John, with a life interest for Lena. Taking over the castle in 1931, Lena and Aubrey turned it into a finishing school for young ladies, the Poggio Gherardo School, they called it. Students learned Italian history from Lena, the Italian language from a moonlighting University of Florence professor, and drawing and art history from Aubrey. The Berensons gave them the run of their superb library, and Kinta, who was living with her parents, took them on field trips all over Tuscany in a big Fiat convertible. In her excellent memoir, A Tuscan Childhood, which some of you may be familiar with, Kinta paints a somewhat racy picture of her own life in the early 1930s, when she caroused with, as she puts it, Florence's version of the bright young things. In 1933, she married an English lawyer, Jack Beaver, and moved to London. Lena, meanwhile, continued reporting on Italy for the Observer until 1935. Somewhat recklessly, she and Aubrey stayed in the country until June 9th, 1940, slipping over the French border just one day before Italy's declaration of war on Britain. We realized our luck later, Lena recalls, when we heard that Blackshirts had gone to Poggio to arrest us and, not finding us, had hurried to Aulla, feeling sure they would catch us there. Aulla is the town where the fortress is. The Waterfields' son John was killed during the war, and Aubrey himself died in 1944. As for Lena, in 1946, she accepted an offer from Ian Fleming, of James Bond fame, to serve as the Italian correspondent for the Sunday Times. And at age 71, nearly lame from an old hip injury, she once again returned to Poggio. Though the estate had been damaged during the war, she was warmly welcomed by its tenants, most of whom had stuck around. To her amazement, one even asked her for her permission for his son to marry. But by 1950, the struggle to keep the place afloat became too much for Lena, and with great reluctance, she sold it. She moved back into the fortress, but it was no place for a septuagenarian on crutches. And in 1952, she finally gave up on Tuscany, spending the rest of her days in Kent. In 1961, she published her autobiography, Castle in Italy, and 3 years later, having just reached 90, she died. After Lena's death, the fortress passed to her son Gordon, who, unable to maintain it, sold it in 1977. After that, the family held no real estate in Tuscany, but its connection to the province and to their matriarch, Janet Ross, lingered. Gordon's son, Michael Waterfield, a well-known chef, had recently edited a new version of Leaves from Our Tuscan Kitchen, and he continued to cook from its recipes at his restaurant in Kent. Gordon himself, meanwhile, became fascinated by the world of his ancestors, writing a biography of Laird, putting together a new edition of Letters from Egypt, and finally writing a biography of Janet that he failed to get published before his death in 1987. Instead, the final word on Janet came from Kinta Beaver, who published A Tuscan Childhood in 1993, just 2 years before her own death at 84. 6 years later, in 2001, Kinta's son Nigel, acting on behalf of the extended family, who include his brother, the leading military historian Anthony Beaver, donated a massive trove of material to the British Institute of Florence. Gathering the correspondence of everyone from Sarah Austin to Kinta Beaver and presided over by an institute co-founded by Lena, the Waterfield Collection, as it's called, symbolizes the family's seven generations of continuity and its four of close involvement with Tuscany. Before releasing you, let me briefly put the spotlight on Janet one last time. What sort of person was she? Though intelligent and learned, especially for an autodidact, she was by no means brilliant, and she made no towering contribution to humanity. She was often rude and overbearing, she could be hell on other women, and her treatment of her son Alec was nothing less than shameful. All the same, her life seems to me singular. Though stretching for 85 years, it had not a single dull spot and was equally free from isolation. She knew a staggering number and variety of people, and I think it's safe to say that nobody has ever been more tightly or continuously woven into the fabric of their time. But it was Tuscany that brought out her best qualities. Where most members of the Anglo-Florentine colony led rather tame and circumscribed lives, Janet was extraordinarily dynamic, supervising her sharecroppers out in the fields all day, and then, quite seamlessly, heading up to her study to write about Stornelli or the private lives of the Medici. Nor was she the least bit self-conscious about any of this. In the countless recent books about Tuscany, books with titles like The Hills of Tuscany, New Life in an Old Land, Vanilla Beans and Brodo, Real Life in the Hills of Tuscany, and, of course, Under the Tuscan Sun, we find the rural life of the province extolled in a rote and artificial manner. By contrast, Janet's affinity was unforced and matter of fact. With a lack of snobbery that was remarkable at the time, she tended to regard Tuscany's peasants more highly than its ruling class, though she was equally comfortable at either end of the social spectrum. In fact, people often remarked that she almost seemed to be a peasant herself. The writer Iris Origo, who knew her as a child and who went on to a career that bears interesting similarities to hers, recalls in her memoirs that she and her mother would sometimes drive over to Pojo to, quote, find old Mrs. Ross reckoning up her olive crop with an eye as shrewd and vigilant as that of any Tuscan farmer. But of course, Janet wasn't a contadina. She was a well-born Englishwoman who'd grown up around lords and ladies and deposed French princes. To me, the fact that she was able, without the least trace of cognitive dissonance, to retain and indeed to relish this profoundly British identity, even as she took on a whole new Mediterranean persona, well, this is a big part of what makes me call her, as her contemporaries once did, the redoubtable Mrs. Ross. Thank you. Happy to take questions. Yes. Wow. I think I knew, but I've forgotten. Near the coast somewhere, but I sorry. Others?
The son never connected, never tried to.
No, it's a very strange. There are very few traces of him. He's. He did come to visit in Florence sometimes, and the Rosses paid for him to go to Oxford, but he was cut out of the inheritance. He didn't get the castle afterwards, and then he was a journalist in Hungary, and he seems to have died during the Second World War, but there's almost no traces of him. So yes, it is. So, yeah, it's an unpleasant side of the story. So,
other people in Florence in the 1890s, Henry James or Edith Wharton, did they have contact with her?
Well, Henry James did. He stayed with her for 3 days out in Castagnolo. I think that's the only time they were together. Edith Wharton, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I wanted Edith Wharton to have met her very much, but I. And she, you know, she was very good friends with Bernard Berenson. I couldn't find any trace of it, and had it happened, I can't imagine the meeting would have gone that well, because Edith Wharton herself was, of course, a very tough lady, and I think it would have been a clash of wills. But, you know, too bad. Anybody else? Yes. Okay. Yes, that's a good book, Paradise of Exiles, yeah. Yeah, I don't think she's considered to be a really serious gardener, to be honest. I mean, and they didn't have anything like the money that, La Pietra, where the Harold Acton's house is, these incredible gardens, because they were rich as Croesus. And so the Rosses were on a pretty small budget. Henry was considered a very serious orchid cultivator. I mean, but, you know, beyond that, I don't think the place had any real distinction as. But it was nice that Katie Campbell wrote about that. And yeah. Others? Yes?
How long did you spend in Italy?
Not very much time, actually. I'm sorry to say. I went on a couple short research trips, and it was mostly gathering materials. Luckily, the British Institute let me photograph, so I just took thousands of pictures of letters and so forth and brought them back. But then also, I did go to the house, to Poggio Gherardo, and to the fortress and Castagnolo. I did go around and see these places, which was extremely helpful. But yeah. It's kind of sad, actually. I mentioned this in the book. It's been turned into a natural history museum, a really bad one, with all these sort of ill-stuffed woodland creatures and gathering dust. And it belongs to the comune, to the town, and it's really depressing. But it's still fun. I mean, you can still walk up on the ramparts, and it's still a very dramatic place. So,
what about
her house? Her house was acquired by a small Catholic order, the Rogationists of the Heart of Jesus, who turned it into basically a boys' home. Which it still is, as far, I mean, that's what it was a couple years ago when I visited. As far as I know, it still is one. She would not have been terribly happy. She, not least, anti-Catholic, but she wouldn't have been thrilled about the idea of it belonging to this order. Let's say, so, yes.
Would she have practiced Anglican?
No, not really. I mean, she was. My sense is that she was fairly agnostic, it's funny that you mentioned it. I mean, there's no record of her ever having been to church, but she wasn't noisy about it. She wasn't like a free thinker or anything like that. She just didn't have a great deal of interest in religion. Yeah. Yes.
About her mother?
Her mother was a wonderful person, Lucy Duff. Did anybody familiar with Lucy Duff Gordon from? There's actually a biography of her 15 or 20 years ago, maybe. She's a very admirable person, and that book, Letters from Egypt, is worth reading. And they had a somewhat strained relationship, but also a close relationship. And I mean, her mother was certainly a more morally impressive person than Jenna Ross herself, but yes.
Did the mother marry? She married Duff Gordon.
Yes, Alexander Duff Gordon. That's right.
No,
he just had he was a baronet, and he just had a lowly job in the Treasury, and then in Inland Revenue, which is like the IRS, basically. So he was a very interesting man. He translated and. Extremely charming by all accounts, but he, his work wasn't especially interesting. Yes.
What was the source of the money? It couldn't have been enough just from the farming.
Well, they salvaged something from Egypt, and I think they'd been quite well off when living in Egypt, so I think what they did salvage was carefully invested, and they were careful to live within their means. And again, the prices were astonishingly low at this time. I mean, it's almost inconceivable how one could live with extremely well on a very small income in Florence at this time. Now they couldn't afford it. They would have had to go somewhere else. So, yes.
Thank you.
So thank you all for coming. And just to remind you, copies of books are for sale outside, and Mr. Downing will be here at the front. And also feel free to come and have a look at the books that we brought out from the collection by Janet Ross. Thanks for coming.